Silently, with gestures, he had made the night sentry, who almost shot him, so mysteriously did he materialize in the dark, get Johnny. He had then led Johnny to this abandoned drift and checked around them with a probe. But the monster did not seem to be attending to what was going on. Johnny had shown him the pictures of the load on a portable viewer he had brought and explained about the overheating motor, about the wind. Turl had emitted a few mutters but little else. For Turl was a very worried cyclo. When the crowd had arrived at the semi-annual, Turl had been efficiently going down the line checking them out. He was almost two-thirds finished when he found himself face to face with him. The newcomer had his head down and the dome firing helmet was not too clean to see through, but there was no mistaking. It was Jayed. Turl had seen him once while a student at the school. There had been a crime nobody ever learned about, and Jayed had been the agent who appeared to handle it. He was not a company agent. He was a member of the dreaded Imperial Bureau of Investigation, the IBI itself. There was no mistaking him. Round, jowled face, left front fang splintered, discolored mouth and eye bones, mange eroding his paws. It was Jayed, all right. It was such a shock that Churl had not been quick-witted enough to go on with his inspection. He had simply passed on the rest of the line. Jayed didn't seem to notice, but the great IBI never missed anything. What was he there for? Why had he come to this planet? On the incoming receipt forms, he was listed as SNIT and designated as General Labor. This meant to Turl that Jayed must be undercover. But why? Was it Numph's messing with payrolls? Or, and Turl shuddered, was it the animals and the gold? His first impulse was to load up blast rifles and rush over and wipe out the animals, return the vehicles, and claim it was all Numph's idea, and that he had had to step in and handle it. For 2 days, however, Turl waited around to see whether Jayed would sidle up to him and confide. He gave the fellow every chance, but Jayed simply went into the general labor force at the local mine. Turl didn't dare put a button camera near him. Jayed would detect that. He didn't dare interrogate the workers around Jayed to see what questions the agent was asking. Jayed would hear it right back. No button cameras appeared in Turl's area. Probes detected no remote devices beaming in on him. A very tense Turl had then decided to be very wary and wait for the first outgoing dispatch box, for Jayed might possibly put a report into it. Sitting there, looking at the load on the screen, Turl gradually forced himself to focus his eyes. Yes, it did appear difficult. He knew it would be.
"You say wind?" said Turl.
"Overheats the motors. A flying drill platform would not be able to hold itself in place long enough to do any effective work." The miner in Turl stirred.
"Long spike rods driven into the cliffside. One could build a platform on that. It's precarious, but the rods sometimes hold."
"One would have to have a place to land on top."
"Blast a flat place out."
Johnny flipped a slide and showed him the crack, the possibility of the whole load shearing off and plummeting to the bottom of the gorge.
"Can't blast." "Drills," said Turl. "Possibly flatten a place with just drills. Tedious, but it could be done. Fly back of the cliff edge and drill toward the chasm."
But he was drifting off, abstracted. Johnny realized that Turl was scared of something. And he realized something else. If this project were abandoned, Turl's first action would be to kill all of them, either to cover evidence or just out of plain sadism. Johnny decided it was up to him to keep Turl interested.
"That might work," said Johnny.
"What?"
said Turl.
"Drilling from back of the chasm toward it, keeping a ship out of the wind while it hovers."
"Oh, that, yes."
Johnny knew he was losing him. To Turl, it wasn't a screen in front of him. It was the face of Jayed.
"I haven't shown you the core," said Johnny.
He tilted the portable lamp and brought the core out of his pocket. It was an inch in diameter and about 6 inches long, pure white quartz and gleaming gold. Johnny tipped it about so it sparkled. Turl came out of his abstraction. What a beautiful specimen. He took hold of it. With one talon, he delicately dented the gold. Pure gold. He fondled it. Suddenly, he saw himself on Cyclo, powerful and rich, living in a mansion, doors open to him everywhere. Talons pointing on the street with whispers, "That's Turl." "Beautiful," said Turl. "Beautiful." After a long time, Johnny said, "We'll try to get it out." Turl stood up in the narrow drift, and dust eddied in the lamp. He still fondly gripped the core. "You keep it," said Johnny. Suddenly, it was as though the core were hot. "No, no, no," said Turl. "You must hide it. Bury it in a hole." "All right, and we'll try to mine the load." "Yes," said Turl. Johnny breathed a pent-up sigh of relief. But at the drift entrance, before they parted, Turl said, "No radio contacts, none. Do not overfly the compound. Skim the mountains on the east. Fly low, leaving and arriving at this base. Make a temporary second base in the hills, and do your shifts from that. And stay away from the compound. I'll see the females are fed."
"I should go over and tell them they won't be seeing me."
"Why?"
"They worry."
Johnny saw that Turl couldn't comprehend that and amended it quickly. "They might make a fuss, create a disturbance."
"Right. You can go once more, in the dark. Here's a heat shield. You know where my quarters are. Flash a dim light 3 times.
"You could just let me take the girls over to the base."
Oh no, you don't."
Turl patted his remote control.
"You're still under my orders."
Johnny watched as he rumbled off and vanished in the night. Fear was preying on Turl, and in that state, Turl would vacillate and change his mind. It was a troubled Johnny who went back to the base. 2. They were overflying the load area, Johnny, Robert the Fox, the 3 near duplicates, and the shift leaders. They were high up. The air was crystal and the mountains spread grandly about them. They were looking for a possible landing site back from the chasm.
"Aye, 'tis the devil's own problem," said Robert the Fox.
"Impossible terrain," said Johnny.
"No, I don't mean that," said Robert the Fox. "It's this Turl demon. On the one hand, we have to keep this mining going and fruitful, and on the other, the last thing we want is for him to succeed. I knew very well he'd kill us all if he lost hope, but I'd rather be dead than see him win."
"Time is on our side," said Johnny, turning the plane for another pass over the edge.
"Aye, time," said Robert the Fox. "Time has a nasty habit of disappearing like the wind from a bagpipe. If we haven't made it by day 91, we're finished."
"McTyler," called Dunaldine from the back, "put your eyes on that space about 200 feet back from the edge. A bit west. That looks flatter."
There was a bark of laughter from the others. Nothing was flat down there. From the edge and back, the terrain was tumbled like a miniature Alps, all stone outcrops and sharp-toothed boulders. No place was flat enough even to set this plane down. "Take over, Dunaldine," said Johnny. He slid sideways and let the Scott into the pilot's seat. Johnny made sure he had control and then went into the back. He picked up a coil of explosive cord and began to put himself into harness. The others helped him. "I want you to hold about 10 feet above that spot. I'll go down and have a try at blasting it flat."
"No,"
said Robert the Fox. He gestured at David McKean, a shift leader.
"Take that away from him, Davy. You're not to be so bold yourself, MacTyler."
"Sorry," said Johnny. "I know these mountains." It was so illogical that it stopped Robert the Fox. He laughed.
You're a bonny lad, McTyler, but a bit wild.
Dunnell Dean had them hovering over the spot, and Johnny wrestled with the door to get it open.
Proves I'm a Scot, he said.
The others didn't laugh. They were too tense with concern. The plane was making small jumps and jerks, and the sharp ground bobbed up and down below. Even here, 200 feet from the edge, there was wind. Johnny was lowered to the ground and let the pickup rope go slack. Not too much blast, or that cliff would shear off again. It might even break off downward. Johnny examined the ground and chose a sharp tooth. He girdled it with explosive cord, getting it as low and level as possible. He set the fuse. At a wave of his hand, the pickup rope tightened and yanked him into the air. He hung there, spinning in the wind. The explosive cord flashed, and the roar racketed around the mountains, echoing. They lowered him again into the wind-whipped dust, and with a spike gun, he drove a spike into the rock he had blasted loose. A line came down to him, and he put it through the eye of the spike. If he had judged correctly, the tooth should shear away. He was hauled up higher. The plane's motors screamed. The rock came away. They lowered the pickup line, and he cut the haul cord with a clipper. The huge rock bounded into a hollow, leaving a flat place where it had stood. For an hour, grounded and hauled away alternately, Johnny worked. Some of the blasted rock fell into nearby hollows. Gradually, a flattish platform 50 feet in diameter materialized 200 feet back from the cliff edge. The plane landed. David, the shift leader, crept over the broken ground to the crack 30 feet in from the edge. The wind buffeted his bonnet. He put a measuring instrument down into the crack that would tell them if it widened in the future. Johnny went over to the edge of the cliff and, with Thor holding his ankles, tried to look under it and see the load. He couldn't. The cliff face was not vertical. The others clambered around, seeing what they could. Johnny came back to the plane. His hands were scraped. This place had to be worked with mittens. He'd ask the old women to make some.
Well, said Robert the Fox, we got Dune.
The daily recon drone rumbled in the distance. They had their orders. The three near duplicates of Johnny dove for the plane and out of sight. Johnny stood out in the open. There was plenty of time. The sharp crack of the sonic boom hit them like a club as the recon drone went overhead. The plane and ground shook. The drone dwindled in the distance.
I hope the vibrations of that thing, said Dunnell Dean, emerging, don't split the cliff.
Johnny gathered the others around him. We have a supply point now. First thing to do is pound in a security fence so nothing can slide off and construct a shift shelter, right? They nodded. Tomorrow, said Johnny, we'll bring 2 planes, one loaded with equipment and the other equipped to drive rods. We'll try to construct a working platform to mine the load, balanced on rods driven into the cliff just below the vein. Survey up here right now on what equipment we need for safety reels, ore buckets, and so on. They got to work to mine the gold they didn't want but had to have. Gold was the bait in the trap.